This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
John Anthony West, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you.
Now, John, you have a really wonderful book that is a favorite of mine called Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt. And that book originally came out with Quest Books, is that correct?
No, it first came out in England.
In England.
But then in America first with Harper and Row, I believe.
Oh, Harper and Row, and then Quest picked it up.
Later on in its paperback format.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. It's one of my, like, absolute favorite books on ancient Egypt. And this book has received a lot of praise and criticism equally from a lot of different quarters. It's greatly respected within the metaphysical community of writing, and some academics like it and some academics don't.
That's not true. Most academics just don't read it or understand it, and the few that have read it sometimes critique it, but never, ever knowledgeably, as it were. They simply dismiss it because it presents a picture of Egypt that is diametrically opposed to the foolishness that they put out there.
Right, right. Now,
there's a bit of a distinction that I'd like to make clear.
Oh, that's very good, and I'm glad you did. And you and Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, who I've had on this program, you're both automatically dismissed, and they never examine any of the evidence. And I can give you a quick example. I was out to dinner with Professor Noor Yalman, who runs a Middle Eastern Studies department at Harvard.
Yeah.
And I mentioned you guys, and he said, oh, those guys should stick to what they know. Schock should stick to rocks. And I said, have you read any of these books? Have you read John Anthony West? Have you read Robert Schock? And he said, no, but I read part of a review in a journal. You know, that's kind of the feedback you get. And Noor is a friend of mine, but Noor shouldn't make generalizations like that without at least reading the book cover to cover, which is...
Well, they all do that, and this is to be expected from the quackademic community.
The quackademic. I mean,
they have neither intelligence nor integrity, and expecting anything from them other than their received opinions is a huge mistake, and people make this big mistake. I mean, it comes up all the time with people who think that because these people have letters after their name that they can think straight, or that they're actually open to anything other than that what they already think they know, and they're not. And it's not until you actually are involved with this stuff that you realize what petty, closed-minded people you are dealing with, and that is what it's like, and it's not going to change. The only way it's going to change, these people do not change their minds. The evidence does not matter. The only way that anything changes is that you blow them out of the water at a certain point. And to the people who are involved in this, Max Planck, the great physicist, has a famous sentence I quoted, I think, in The Serpent. The Serpent, remember, is published in late 70s somewhere. To the effect, I won't get it exactly right, but that new ideas never take root because of, or never are accepted because of, the quality of the evidence. What happens is that the old guard dies out, and new people, young people who have been brought up with the new ideas and who don't think them that challenging, take over, and then gradually it changes. So this is really the way it is, and anybody who expects anything else from the establishment just doesn't understand what the establishment is like. And fortunately, if you are, like me, a good Gurdjieffian, and this is your background as well, so you know what I'm talking about, if you know that it is a spiritual exercise not to get your buttons pressed by these people or by anyone else for that matter, you can take it as a useful challenge. And once it's a useful challenge, the bitterness is taken out of it, because it's your own responsibility to not react to all of this idiocy.
Well, that's very well put, John. Now, you really summed it up. And, you know, there are certainly diamonds in the dung heap of academia, like people like Robert Schoch and Houston Smith and Jacob Needleman, but they tend to be as disgusted with the system as anybody outside it.
Even more so.
They're very, very frustrated people. Now, John, could you give us your web page so we could find out where we can purchase this book?
Sure, of course. JAWest.net or .com.
J.A. West, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, you can get it on Amazon. You know, it's in print, so you can get it on Amazon or whatever you're looking for. But, yeah, people can get it from me, and then they get it autographed. So.
Oh, very good. At jawest.com, if you want to get The Serpent in the Sky, an autographed copy,
right?
That would be, that's wonderful. That's a good option. And I noticed, too, that you do a very fascinating tours of Egypt. Could you tell our listeners a bit about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. In part, of course, I have to pay the mortgage, so esoteric literature is not famous for selling well, so... I'm living proof that fame and fortune do not necessarily go together. but actually, the Egypt trips I've been doing for 25 years, and these are, I almost hate to use the word because it's so overused, genuinely transformational experiences. Because, in fact, I often say, I quote myself, Judge Bernard Shaw used to say, I always quote myself, it spices up the conversation. It's like that, but I often, the people say, oh, what's so special about Egypt? And my response is that Egypt is like sex. And they say, well, why is it like sex? And I say, well, you can read about it all you want, and you can even look at pictures, but until you've experienced it, you don't know anything about it. So Egypt is like that. I mean, I'm very proud of Serpent in the Sky. It's been around a long time. It's got an audience. It's out there. But it is what it's supposed to be, an in-depth introduction to the work of the man I consider maybe the greatest scholar of all time, the genius with the unpronounceable name R.A. Schwalla de Lubitsch. Still, it is just a book, and it goes into your head, not into your gut or into your heart. And when you're in Egypt and you see it through these symbolists, called the symbolist interpretation of Egypt, but when you get there and you have your experiences explained, I mean, the experiences are the experiences. You don't need me for that. But without the symbolist interpretation, you can't understand your own experience. You get moved by architecture in a way that for Americans, it's almost impossible because we don't have sacred architecture in this country. The secrets have been lost, or anyway, put it this way, we don't have much of it. There's a bit of it. The Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York is actually a piece of sacred architecture. Somebody still knew the secrets. But by and large, we don't have anything, I mean, we hardly have anything that looks any good at all or that's pleasing to the eye. And Egypt is, I'll tell you, it's the home of the greatest sacred architecture that ever was. And you walk into these places, and when you see them the right way, and in my trips, I go way out of my way to, I mean, we spend a lot of time, and we get up at the crack of dawn, and we're at places where nobody else is there, which takes some doing, because Egypt is pretty crowded. But when you're there, you experience architecture in a way that most Americans don't know that architecture even has this kind of quality. It puts you, the purpose of sacred architecture is to connect you to a higher level of consciousness. And that's exactly what they do. And it's just words when I say it even now. I mean, I know what I'm talking about, but it's still just words until you get there. And then suddenly you see what's going on. And then extrapolating from that, then you understand why Egypt is that important, is and why we have this bitter conflict between, let's say, ourselves, the simplest interpretation, and everyone else. And the reason is that it is for the people who oppose it a complete lifestyle change. To accept it means to deny everything that has been brought up with in their education, everything that says that we're the most advanced beings that ever existed, and we're not. We're actually probably the most degenerate people that ever existed. We're clever, but we're degenerate. And in Egypt, you get a sense of what a real civilization once was like, which you don't get anywhere else. Nowhere else in the world can you still get that experience. You can a little bit. You can go to Europe and get the Gothic cathedrals, and you can go to India and the great mosques of Islam, but you don't get it day after day and piece after piece with the kind of sophistication and the kind of grandeur that you do get in Egypt. So it is, and this is what I mean by transformational, it is an opportunity to experience what human beings are really supposed to be like. In other words, where our priorities are supposed to lie. I mean, they're not in Wall Street or Walmart or, you know, the kind of garbage that we occupy our lives with. Our role is to recognize that we as human beings have a role to play in this grand cosmic scheme. And a part of that role, doesn't have to be that way, but in Egypt it was that way, was the focus upon this amazing art and architecture that actually puts you in touch with higher levels of being. And actually we get that. I mean, you get it in certain Western music. You don't get it from gangster rap, but you can get it from certain pieces of Bach and Monteverdi and Beethoven. And so it's there. But it's not the central issue of the entire civilization. And in Egypt it was. You've got a whole civilization that's dedicated to one single issue, which is the immortality of the soul. And it sounds like just words and rather, you know, sort of highfalutin words, but when you're in Egypt, you sense it. In other words, it's visceral. You have the experience that it's like sex. You're experiencing it. And once you've experienced it and you get it explained back to you in a way that you can process what you've experienced with your head, because I mean, that's what the head is good for, processing experience. The head does not in and of itself experience. The experience is visceral and emotional, and you get that, but unless you can explain it to yourself, it may be powerful, but you can't, let's say, you can't put it into words to explain it to anyone else. So Egypt serves that function, and almost nothing else does. Well, that's why I do the trips, apart from paying the mortgage.
Oh, very good. I mean, that's a wonderful reason. I mean, I do a lot of cruises and lecture cruises, and all I can offer is cha-cha lessons. So what you're doing is like, it's very profound to immerse yourself in a traditional architectural culture. It's a different milieu than, as you said, anyone here can understand, especially in the United States. It's really tough to express it in words, and it's worthwhile. I understand you and Professor Robert Schock are going to do a co-tour very soon. And for anyone out there listening, this is maybe a once-in-a-lifetime chance to actually go to Egypt with John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schock. You know, you can brag about this 20 or 30 or 40 years from now if you're younger after we're all gone. And
I don't know. Who said?
Well, I'm not the man upstairs, but just, you know, statistically.
I'm planning on sticking. I don't know what statistics. I don't believe in statistics.
Okay, all right. Okay, like Mark Twain says, there's lies, damn lies, then there's statistics. So right. maybe you can go on another one with John Anthony West and Robert Schock 40 years from now.
Well, 40 years, I don't know about that, but... 20, who knows? Anyhow, 20. I'm just joking. But yeah, Shock and I have been talking about this for a long time, but we've not done it, but it would be, we're both busy and we got millions of things to do, but we keep talking about it. There's no, in other words, we were saying this, but we don't have, let's say there's nothing on the website that says, well, yeah, we're going to do this at such and such a date. We are talking about it, and we hope to do it. In fact, we're hoping to do it. In the middle of when? In June, we're sort of talking about maybe doing this. But so far, it hasn't. It's not there yet. So.
It's not there, but I just wanted to let my listeners know once more, this is a golden opportunity, and you can find out information at robertshock.com, S-C-H-O-C-H, robertshock.com, or you could email Mr. West at jawest.com or .net. And this is just such a wonderful opportunity. I just wanted the Sphinx, this is Sphinx Radio, so it's perfectly appropriate that I really plug this particular trip to Egypt. This is a really wonderful thing to go with Robert Shock and John Anthony West. It's just, it's a great adventure. And not only will you be immersed in this wonderful, traditional, ancient, mystical architecture, but you'll be able to ask questions and share your initial experience with these things with two of the greatest Egyptologists in the world at this time. So any listeners of Sphinx Radio, I strongly urge you to check this out. This would be this is a really unique experience in the metaphysical community. And this is, like I say, this is one thing you don't want to miss out on. So to my listeners, certainly look into this at jawest.net. Now, John, could you tell us a bit? I saw a few things. You do a podcast, and what can people expect when they listen to your podcasts?
Oh, they can expect a lot of fireworks, verbal fireworks.
Very good, yeah.
That's Phoenix Fire, and that, again, you access through my website. And there, unfortunately, my time is so, I'm so swamped with work that I find it difficult to get the spare time off to add to it. But I think there are now 8 or 9 episodes on there, and I ramble on about things that I know about and feel passionately about. So there's a lot of Egypt on there, but there are a lot of other things as well, because Egypt, as you might have gathered from what we were talking about, Egypt is not just a quibble amongst academics, but it really has to do with our philosophically, metaphysically, what our role in the grand cosmic scheme is. So that takes us into all sorts of things, even into economics and politics and all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect Egypt to touch upon. And then, because I started out not as a scholar, but rather as a novelist and playwright and screenwriter, takes us into literature and the arts and all of that sort of thing. And so I don't think I have less of an audience than Rush Limbaugh, I guess, but it is a somewhat different subject, and people seem to like them. So your listeners, pull up my website and click on whatever it is, the Phoenix Fire clicks, and surf around, and you might find stuff that you find amusing and engaging and instructive, maybe. Anyhow, amusing.
So, oh yeah, they're very, very good, and you touch upon some really wonderful topics there, and I strongly urge people to listen to several of them. Now, there's another thing I want people to take a look at concerning John Anthony West on YouTube. He has a wonderful interview with him and someone I greatly admire, Webster Griffin Tarpley. There's a one.
Yeah, thanks. You saw that? Okay.
I did. I do my homework, John. I'm a big fan of yours, John. You don't realize it. I'm a big, big fan. And that's about a 40-minute interview, and it's a wonderful interview because you get John Anthony West, who's looking at the current world more from a traditional or ancient history-minded perspective. And then you get Webster Tarpley, who likewise draws from the ancient world, but he kind of focuses in on, you know, our contemporary situation, as you both do. But that's a wonderful exchange you did, and that's on YouTube. And just punch in John Anthony West, and it will pop right up. And that's well worth taking a look at as well. Now, John, you have another book I found really fascinating called The Case for Astrology.
Yes.
Which, that book really stunned me because, to be honest, I was a huge astrology skeptic.
Yeah.
For many, many years. And then I read your book, and it made me rethink a few things, and I talked a few things over with Colin Wilson.
All right.
As well. And it's quite amazing because the same thing we were talking about, the academic community which jumped on this, like John Wheeler, the Nobel Prize winning scientist, really harped on astrology. And I kind of fell in with him for a while, but after reading your book and these conversations with Colin Wilson, it's very convincing. There is a case for astrology.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And could you tell us how you came to write that book?
Pardon?
How did you come to write that book?
Oh,
I'm just curious.
Time. We only have a few minutes. But I didn't start out with these interests, really. I got interested in astrology when I was living in Spain on the island of Ibiza. And I started out as a novelist, playwright, screenwriter. I mean, I had an agenda, which was that I knew that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum, and I wanted to be the little boy that says the emperor has no clothes. But I had none of these metaphysical interests, but they grew on me. I mean, I had a lot of stuff published and produced. Actually, I'm having some of it republished soon, things that are out of print. But I got interested in it while I was living in Spain, and then I have a novel produced and published in the 60s, and I moved to England. I've been in Ibiza for 9 years, and got friendly with my editor, who was a mathematician, rationalist, skeptic, turned publisher, but we were good friends, even though we had very different philosophical views on things. And one day, the subject of astrology came up, and he said, "This is in England. Oh, that's a lot of codswallop." And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, it isn't. This is a subject I know a lot about, and I can provide you with evidence that proves that you can make a case for astrology." So he said, "Well, I'd like to see that." And one thing led to another, and suddenly there was a contract that I had to then get professional about. And it's exactly that. It's not that astrology can tell you, maybe it can, but not scientifically, not statistically satisfactorily, what's a good day to buy a poodle or a stock, but that that there is a connection, and a very profound connection, between, let's say, the movements of the heavens and events, or anyway, personalities here on Earth. There's a lot of solid stuff there. Some of it is direct, more of it is indirect, but when you get finished, if you're a good lawyer, you see that there really is a case. And I mean, that's all that it says. It doesn't say that astrology is going to tell you what a good day to buy a poodle is, but that there is a case to be made for it, that these correspondences, rather than influences, correspondences do exist. That's formal, and that's it. I mean, there's the book, and go argue.
All right. It's very persuasive, and it's another John Anthony West book I strongly recommend.
Unfortunately, out of print at the moment, but one of these days